The great 19th century poet Emily Dickinson asked us to dwell in possibility. If that statement is a paradigm for anyone, it is certainly applicable to today's guest, a man who has dedicated his life to sharing his passion for the endless possibilities of our cosmos. With us at Poets Cafe is Neil deGrasse Tyson.
On canvas with paint in the artist's school, it is red that is hot and blue that is cool. But in science we show that, as the heat gets higher, that a star will glow red like the coals of a fire. Raise the heat some more, and what is in sight? It's no longer red, it has turned bright white. Yet the hottest of all, I say unto you, is neither white nor red when the star has turned blue.
I love it. Welcome, Neil. Oh, so great to have you on the show. For listeners tuning in to Poets Cafe, Neil deGrasse Tyson needs little introduction. Many people follow your work as an astrophysicist and guest speaker, host of Nova Science, and of course, a director of the Hayden Planetarium, and now you're unofficially a poet.
No, I'm a rhymer. you need a subcategory to poets. They're the people who just rhyme words. That's what I am.
You're a great rhymer, and in fact, you're on Twitter. You do a lot of rhyme on Twitter, don't you?
Yeah. Thanks for noticing that. Actually, only when I'm describing a cosmic phenomenon that's visible in the night sky. So, for example, a beautiful crescent moon or a juxtaposition of planets. Then I give those tweets, alerting people of that event or that view, I give those tweets in rhyme. And the reason why I do that is I never want someone to accuse me of destroying the majesty of a beautiful view by layering it with, you know, boring science. You know, some people just want to enjoy a sunset. And so if there's a beautiful sunset or a moonrise or anything else that I know people would just want to sit and bask in its beauty, I give those tweets in rhymes. And it's really, I'm just trying to insulate myself from criticism of destroying the beauty of a moment.
But it's great because it shows a sensitivity to and an affinity for words.
Yeah, well, I like words. And in particular, something I discovered about myself, that one of the reasons why I happen to like Broadway musicals, the best of them take simple words and rhyme them or juxtapose them in ways that communicate emotion. Simple emotion, granted, you know, boy meets girl, but I always like the turn of phrase that would be exhibited in a good Cole Porter lyric or Gershwin phrase. And so I thought to myself, if people flock to hear a beautiful song, then maybe they would flock to read beautifully written science. If I tap some of those resources of the lyricists. So there's a secret part of me that actually wants to be a librettist of Broadway musicals.
You see, we're outing you here.
Don't tell anybody.
I even hear you have a special pen with which you like to write. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. I like fountain pens, and I also have some feather pens that you create. You know, you get a feather and you cut the tip to be the original, right, a quill pen tip. It's a quill, of course. And I like the romance of dipping ink. And, of course, when you travel, you can't bring dipping ink. So the next best thing is the fountain pen. So I have a small but very, very important for me collection of fountain pens. And when I do write with a fountain pen, I feel myself sort of communing through time with others who pen their best words just with sort of liquid ink sitting there. And a lost art, of course, is being able to read what someone wrote and have the way that the letters are laid to the page influence how you feel when you read the words, right? And that's just lost. In fact, the typewriter rendered that sort of an obsolete way. I would claim that the writing words and letters by hand is the written equivalent of body language when you're speaking. And if you pay attention to body language, it can bring so much more interpretation to what someone is thinking or feeling than simply reading a transcript of their words or even just listening to them without viewing them. So when I handwrite my speeches or notes, I feel like I'm expressing more of myself than if I just type them up. And it's you also get to draw some letters of a word different from others. You know, a typewriter, every letter is the same when it appears again in a document. And so maybe the last letter of a letter that you're writing has a particular kind of flourish, and then you say, oh, he's done. You know, when you have fountain pens, and all of my fountain pens do something interesting with the text, so with the ink on the page. So there's something called a stub nib that allows you to do some nice calligraphy. There are soft nibs. By the way, I'm on a moving train. You might hear the conductor speaking. So the pen nibs that I have all do something expressive on the page, and they can do calligraphy. Another one, I have a soft tip that spreads when you press down on it, and then when you lift up, it gets narrow again. And this is the kind of fonting that goes on with sort of wedding invitations, that kind of script. So I like exploring ways to express the words I write that way as well. So every pen has a way to express what you put on the page. Otherwise, you know, just go use a ballpoint pen, which makes the same line in every direction you push it.
You know what I noticed something is when you, you know, after you've emailed back and forth with someone over a period of time, then you get a handwritten letter from them, and it's as if all their energy is coming through. You know, you really do get a sense of their personality, and it does add another layer. I totally agree with that.
Yeah, it's a lost layer today. Now, I don't want to judge it, its absence, because, you know, times change, right? And there, I think in the world of texting, which is even another step removed from a typed letter, right? Now you're not even putting in all the words that should be there. You're abbreviating, you're truncating. And I think some people recognize that they're missing a way to express the emotion. So they've developed a way to try to compensate. So the good old LOL, you know, laughed out loud, you're telling someone that you just laughed because you can't see it and they can't otherwise find some other way to express it. So, and then they have the emoticons. These are the little, the colon dash right parentheses that follows in a letter is a sideways face smiling. So I think people deep down recognize that they've lost some emotional dimension to their communication. They're trying to compensate.
And that's the beauty of poetry. You know, that's one of the things that poetry can do. In fact, I was thinking about, you know, Carl Sagan's book Contact. And, you know, there's that scene, well, in the film, actually, when Jodie Foster is traveling through the wormholes and she's completely ecstatic and she says, oh, it's beautiful. I had no idea. They should have sent a poet. This is host Lois B. Jones, and we're here on Poets Cafe with special guest Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. coming back to it, I never realized, and I thought to myself, why did Sagan suggest a poet? You know, why not a musician or painter, sculptor? What do you think?
Okay, I actually have extensive thoughts on that matter. And let me start out by saying one of my great personal revelations regarding poetry, and I don't know if this is standard, you know, poetry 101 and everybody knows it, but I had to figure it out on my own, that I think the poet is best tapped to enable others to recognize the beauty in things you take for granted. Whereas, I'll give you an example of the inverse of that. So when we landed on the moon in 1969, there was a special section of the New York Times that had people expressing themselves in response to the fact that we landed on the moon. And there were some poems in there and some short prose. And the poems were decidedly uninteresting to me. They were perfunctory. You know, we have pierced the sky. We have, you know, they're saying things. It's like, look, I saw the ship go up. I felt that. I don't need you to help me feel that because the moment itself was transcendent. And so I realized I don't need a poet to have me transcend a transcendent moment. The moments do all the talking themselves. I need the poet to highlight something that I'm otherwise missing about the world, that I've taken for granted, that I've forgotten how to recognize. Then the world around me comes to life. And take it to the music, for example. One of Beethoven's least interesting musical pieces is his celebration of Wellington's victory over Napoleon. And it's called Wellington's Victory. And it's like, what? You know, why are you wasting my time with this? It was an important event in the history of warfare and geopolitics. But the music was not making it more for me. In fact, it was making it less. So, and then I think of, you know, I don't know how you guys view it, but the fact that it's well known is fact enough. The poem about the tree, Joyce Kilmer, it's a tree, for goodness sake. You know, we've all seen trees, yet that's a highly retold poem. And because we forget to notice the trees, and there's an extraordinary thing happening, then I don't think I need the poet, because I can contain it within my own mind. Take me to a place I haven't been and remind me of its beauty. And so that's how I view the expression of the artist. You know, do you need an artist to paint a scene of a famous battle? No, I need an artist to show me something I've never thought of before, to take me to a place I've never been before, to have me feel and reach emotions that have never been tapped before. And I think that is art at its best, art in all levels and flavors, of course, poetry among them. So that's my personal revelation regarding this. And so in that moment where Jodie Foster says it should have brought a poet, as it is, but really it's the sort of the data of that moment. I mean, she's experiencing something that no one had ever experienced before. And I really want an accurate accounting of that. Because
it's very difficult. I think that's when we run into the ineffable. And so that's when we reach for poetry or some of the other arts that try somehow to bring the beauty that lies in complex things and try and in some ways simplify it.
I guess we can split it two ways. So one is I'm steeped in something that transcends my capacity to express myself. Then I bring in the poet. And I'll give you that. I concede that. It's more often that there's something that I forgot how to love or forgot how to see, and then the artist reminds me of it.
What might spark a connection for you personally between science and poetry?
I think there are certain ideas that are simply poetic. One of my most heavily viewed YouTube clips, which someone posted from a documentary that was on the History Channel, was I was sort of waxing poetic about our relationship to the universe, or rather waxing emotional about that relationship. And I said, I'm not going to get it exactly right because I'm always better when the camera's rolling. Something, the intensity of the moment makes it come out better than me just trying to remember it. So it was, I noted that what we've learned in 20th century astrophysics is that we're all connected to each other biologically, to the Earth chemically, and to the rest of the universe atomically. And this is a beautiful, for me, it's a beautiful expression of sort of the oneness of the cosmos. And once you realize that interconnectedness of species, our relationship to the Earth and to the universe, you no longer feel lonely in the cosmos. You become a participant in its epic unfolding of events. You feel more as a protector of things. For example, once you know you're connected to other animals, you might have a little more empathy or sympathy for their plight. There was a day when humans were something distinct and special, and the animals were just lowly, you know, the lower life forms. And so if that's how you viewed them, why concern yourself with whether you bring pain or suffering to them? But once you recognize the commonality of the DNA and of the biology that connects us all, then it forces you to take a different perspective on the animal kingdom, on life, on Earth, and on the universe itself.
And I love that idea because there's a sense of awe in it, and a sense of largeness, which I've noticed when I've looked at your YouTube videos and heard you speak. This expansive view, which I think the arts does too. We gaze at the night sky, you know, and you were talking about your pilgrimage and your day becoming evening and your clock to match the rhythm of the night, you know. This is a moment I actually perceived you as a poetic being.
Well, thank you. In fact, that's actually a lost activity, the pilgrimage to the mountaintop, to sit alone in the telescope dome, communing with the cosmos. Because in the digital era, all the data are taken digitally. And once it's digitally encoded, you just send it across the wire or send it wirelessly to another state or another country. So nowadays, you observe from mountaintops in the comfort of your office, wherever your office happens to be. And so there's a lost bit of romance there, I think. But it's more efficient, and the point of it all was to get data on the cosmos. So I lament it, but I accept it. I accept the change.
We always have this romantic idea of Hubble, you know, staring out of his telescope at the stars, and I think that's how we think in those terms, you know, that romantic.
Yeah, Hubble the man in this case that you're describing. I would also say that what you're describing as trying to get a new view on the world to the astrophysicist we call it the cosmic perspective. It's a point of view that establishes the honest relationship that you have with the rest of the world and the rest of the universe. And this is why in modern times, when I see artists reaching for cosmic themes to serve as their muse, be they sculptors or painters or musicians, poets, that I see it as a way for these creative people to broaden the kinds of stories they can tell and the kinds of thoughts they can have. Because all the universe is not the Earth, and all the Earth is not just human interaction. There's much more to reach for. And there was a day when most of the musing influence to the artist were, for example, sort of Bible stories or mythologies. And now that the artist is reaching for, from what I've seen, they're embracing scientific themes. And I don't even want to call it science at that level. They're embracing nature. And I'm enchanted by that, and I see no end of possibilities of where the creative energies can go.
This is host Lois P. Jones, and we're here on Poets Cafe with special guest Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. And there's that correlation again between artists and scientists, because there's the idea of the reaching out to go into territories, terra incognita, and the importance of our continued exploration, which I know is a very important driving theme for you.
Yeah, and there's interesting similarity, and there's a very important difference between the two. So the similarity is art and science are two fundamentally human activities, right? No other creature does either. And art and science, you know the saying, if someone is really good at something, you would say, he's raised it to an art. But they'll also might say, oh, he's got it down to a science, right? Those two, art and science, go together in that. When you're complimenting someone's creativity or precision of what it is they're engaged in. And art and science are one of the fundamental duets of the history of education. You know, there's the colleges of arts and sciences. This is so there's an important recognition that creativity is fundamental to both enterprises. And I don't think that is recognized enough by those who think about both fields. But there's an important difference between the two that is also not recognized. And that is the artist is unconstrained by forces outside of themselves, fundamentally. And whereas the scientist is, ultimately, the scientist has to answer to nature. The scientist can't invent something to be true that is not otherwise true in nature. As a result, when a scientist makes a discovery, we all recognize that if that scientist hadn't made that discovery, someone later will have made exactly that same discovery. Whereas Beethoven's Ninth Symphony or Van Gogh's The Starry Night, no one before or after could have possibly created those works of arts but them. And so the artist's creation is a singular expression of human creativity, whereas the scientific discoveries are shared discoveries, shared expressions of human creativity. Now, not everyone would make the scientific discoveries that are made, but all we're saying is that the discovery in the universe is something that would ultimately happen with someone else. So the arbiters are different at the end of the day. But nonetheless, you still have to be creative, and you still have to think in ways that others hadn't thought before in order to make the discoveries that await you.
Well, Stephen Hawking made a statement describing the universe as being finite but unbounded. So in certain ways, there's a finite sense, but with artists, it's more infinite but unbounded.
Well, I think, dare I, you know, step out of where my expertise is here and say that I don't think, in spite of what I just said, that an artist has no limits. I think, in fact, the artist does have limits. The artist has to reach for a place. The artist does have limits, and those are the likelihood that others would embrace their expression of creativity. And why is it that we only remember some artists throughout history, not others? There are others who attempted to be creative in some way or didn't transcend the expectations or the priorities or the love or the emotion of the day and just failed as artists. I mean, so not all artists succeed, and there's some reason for that. They're reaching to a place that does not resonate with our deepest sort of souls of creativity or appreciation or emotions. But what intrigues me most about great art is how often it's unappreciated in its day. And then people have to sort of catch up with it, and then they embrace it. As some of the greatest art they've ever seen. There are easy examples of that, especially the works of Van Gogh. You know, now going for some of the highest auction prices ever. And if you just were around back then and told people that, you know, they would think you were crazy. So I'm intrigued by that, and I wonder, you know, what is wrong with people? Or what is slow about people that they can't recognize? They're not in a position to recognize genius, but someone later is. I wonder if that's a studied problem.
It is an interesting question, isn't it? Because we never seem to get the acknowledgement in our lifetime. It happens afterward, as if you can't say something is great, almost.
Yeah, in fact, in science, the good thing about it is if you're right, it's tested and the experiments show it, and then you get celebrated in your lifetime. There's no case of a scientist who made a discovery that was important where people just waited till they were dead before before they said that they were great. So it could be because, you know, when it's evidence-based, it's not subject to someone's opinion at that point. Whereas to appreciate a work of art, there's strong opinions that are floated, not only when the work of art is created, but there's the evolution of those opinions over time. And so that intrigues me. And it may be that the evolution of opinions diverges from what is required to appreciate the art, and those are the artists that are forgotten.
And we have so many critics in art, too. Well, of course, there's critics in science as well, but it's, you can't, when you have some type of discovery which has empirical value, you can't necessarily criticize its value.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Yeah, there's no role for critics when something has an objective reality and an objective value. I've always been curious, why do art critics even exist? Because from what I can see, they're never as talented as the people who they're criticizing. So what's the point? What's the point of their craft?
Right. But this is the point, because they don't have the talent, unfortunately. So their efforts are brought down several notches to talking about it rather than doing it. And some art critics wouldn't appreciate my saying that, but I think that there's some truth in it.
Well, see, so then I can say it then, because I don't care what they think of me. I'm in a different field.
Yeah.
So
we have to wrap up now. And all right, so you're going to take us out with one of your poems.
Sure. This is from my book, Merlin's Tour of the Universe, where it's just a question and answer book that people write in. And so this is actually a limerick where someone named Anna asks, is there up or down in space? It's important for Anna to test that one man's east is another man's west. And in space, where there is no up or down, one man's smile is another man's frown.
Great. Thank you. You've been listening to Poets Cafe with host Lois P. Jones and today's special guest, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil, big thanks for being on our show.
Thanks for having me. I don't often get to speak to poets, so this is great for me.
It's great for us, too. And thanks also to our wonderful producer, Marlena Bond. Be sure to stop by on your way to Jupiter and friend us on Facebook. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming live on the web for all of Southern California and beyond.